Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. One of the great challenges of our time is the inequality in both income and wealth. The wealth gap is large and growing. The top 1% now owns more wealth than 90% of the rest of us combined. It may seem inevitable that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, but a closer look tells a different story. The rules of the game are stacked in favor of the wealthy. Those with wealth benefit by massive subsidies and tax breaks, not set in stone, but established in laws passed by Congress. Those laws can be changed. Moreover, the lack of resources in working families is a condition that can be changed. There are actions we can take that will enable more Americans to get an education, buy a home, start a business, and take part in the American dream. Our first guest today, Chuck Collins, has dedicated his life to finding ways to increase prosperity for all. He will be followed by a representative of Vital Voices, a global network of women speaking out for equality worldwide. Chuck Collins is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits the website inequality.org. He is author of several books, including the popular book Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. He is co-author with Bill Gates Sr. of the book Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which makes the case for taxing inherited fortunes. His most recent book is titled, Is Inequality in America Irreversible? Chuck Collins is co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good, a network of business leaders, high-income households, and partners working together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. That network merged with the group Patriotic Millionaires. He is an expert on U.S. inequality and the racial wealth divide and a longtime friend and colleague of mine. Chuck Collins, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited you're here. I've wanted you on the show for a very long time. So let's dive right in. Can you help our listeners understand what is happening in terms of wealth at the top of the economy? How concentrated is wealth in the U.S.?
Well, I think you started off with a pretty good statistic, but I would just say that over the last 40 years, the rules of the economy have been tipped to benefit asset owners, people who own a lot of wealth, at the expense of wage earners. And so the wealth is funneling not to the top, just the top 1%, but most of the income and wealth gains have gone to the top 0.1%. People whose incomes are over $3 million and whose wealth starts at about $20 million. That's where most of the wealth is pooling. And the higher up you go up the wealth ladder, the more concentrated it is, to the point where now three billionaires, Bezos, Buffett, and Gates, together have as much wealth as the bottom half of all U.S. households combined. So that's how out of balance we are.
That's really staggering. And I notice the Federal Reserve is kind of even gotten some data on this showing that nearly two-fifths of people in the United States don't have the cash on hand to cover a $400 emergency. I mean, it's gotten to the point where we're like hollowing out the middle class, and it seems like it's a big vacuum cleaner going up to the top 0.1%. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I think that that image of wealth being hoovered up from the middle and the bottom. Part of the reason there's such an imbalance, as you say, one out of five households has zero or negative wealth. And if you look at that through a racial lens, almost one out of three African-American households has zero or negative wealth. And then the next fifth has very little to fall back on. You know, you have a car repair or a medical bill. You don't have the cash on hand, the cash reserves. So that's why these inequalities really matter. It's not just a matter of the rich getting richer. It's how it's affecting every other person and the society and culture as a whole.
Right, exactly. And once these super rich get all their resources, they're actually using it to actively rig the rules even more in their favor, right? I mean, what do you see the impact of the super rich on our government?
Well, I think that's one of the sort of, once wealth starts to concentrate at a high level, it sort of kicks into autopilot, meaning that the wealthy are using their power to get more wealth and power. And that's actually sort of the definition of an oligarchy, a society where there's a segment of people who are so wealthy that they use their money to defend their wealth, both in the political arena by, you know, lobbying for tax cuts and rules that benefit them, but also in their financial dealings. They you know, hire professionals to help them hide their money. Both those things lead to growing, you know, kind of spiraling upward inequality, and it's very tough to reverse it the more concentrated it gets.
Right, exactly. And I've seen studies showing that people who are extremely wealthy mostly think that they deserve it, that they worked hard, that they're smart, so that they deserve what they have. And oftentimes even people who don't have much wealth blame themselves for it. But what you're talking about really is kind of a whole vicious cycle of, you know, wealth gets more and more concentrated, and as it gets concentrated, the wealthy use their power to rig the rules more in their favor. So it's not so much of individual failure or individual brilliance and success, but really it's kind of a structural cyclical problem that makes it harder. If you're poor and in the middle class, you're more likely to stay there, and if you're wealthy, you're more likely to keep getting wealthier. Is that how it's working?
Yeah, and I think you're pointing to the power of stories that tell people, that people mm-hmm. tell about themselves or about others in relation to these inequalities. And I call it the myth of deservedness.
You know, that's great.
You imply, as people say, why is there inequality? Why do some people have so much more than others? And a lot of people will say, well, that's because, you know, the people at the top, they worked harder and they took risks and they're smarter and they applied themselves. And then there's sort of the shadow side of that story, which is, well, if you're struggling economically, there must be something wrong with you, or you must have some kind of deficiency. And that simplistic mythology or story is one of the things that holds these inequalities in place, because mm-hmm. As many, and I think women in politics get this faster, because I think men, we tend to sort of have our Marlboro Man, Lone Ranger theory of individual development, as opposed to seeing that we're all part of a web, and that society and families and communities are critical factors in helping individuals make it and survive and even succeed, as opposed to sort of all individual effort. So that, you know, part of our work is to change the rules and the public policies, but a really important part of the work is to change the false stories and mythologies about wealth and inequality.
Right, exactly, and in part because people who are in the poor middle class kind of blame themselves for their situation. And they also, you know, they hope, they keep the hope alive that they're going to become a millionaire, whether they have a car accident or win the lottery or they work harder and do better, that they're going to end up a millionaire. So they think it's unfair to tax the wealthy more, and they see it as punishing success. What do you have to say to people who say it's unfair to tax the wealthy more?
Well, you know, part of why we have a tax system is so that we can make public investments that create actual real opportunity. So if you believe that myth about it's all about individual deservedness and effort, then yeah, why would you want to have public expenditures in education and healthcare and college and, you know, public investments in infrastructure that help support businesses, because it's all about the individual. And what I think I'm trying to say is it's the opposite. It's all about, individual effort matters, you know. I mean, between you and I, Eleanor, you might be more of a go-getter than me, and you get up earlier in the morning and you work harder and you know, but that doesn't mean you and I should be paid you should be paid 1,000 times more than me, you know, or 10,000
right.
times more.
Mm-hmm.
You might be paid a little bit more, but that simplistic story about, oh, individual effort kind of gets projected onto the whole economy. So I would just say the simple thing is no one does it alone, and that if we, you know, Bill, it's very important to have a progressive tax system and make investments in things that lift up everyone, and that real opportunity and wealth creation come about because of things that we all do together, not just our own individual effort.
Yes, and the person who I thought really made that case most eloquently was Senator Elizabeth Warren from our state there, Massachusetts, and she spoke very powerfully about, you know, it's great if you set up your own business and make a lot of money, and, you know, good for you for that, and keep in mind that anyone who's made money has done it because the rest of us have all contributed to a good education, so people can, you can have trained workers, the roads and the bridges so you can bring your goods to market, the infrastructure of the phones and everything else, the computers, that really, it's hats off to you, and I'm thrilled for people to be millionaires and multimillionaires if they've got a good idea and they make a business and make it work. And we've got to be paying fair taxes to pay back into the system that made that success possible and make it possible for other people. And I actually think a lot of people who have wealth don't want to think that they have wealth at the expense of someone else even having a decent life. But the structure we have of the tax system particularly kind of makes that difficult. But so talk a little bit. You've worked with some of the people who have had enormous wealth, and they recognize this. Tell our listeners a little bit about the work you're doing with the wealthy people who think we need to make some changes here.
Yeah, well, similar to the story you said about Senator Elizabeth Warren, I think back almost 20 years, Bill Gates' dad, the founder of Microsoft's father, Bill Gates Sr., he got very involved in an effort to defend the inheritance tax, the estate tax, which some people call the death tax. And he was also really eloquent about, you know, he'd say, look, the reason why wealthy people should pay high taxes is because they have disproportionately benefited from the public investments that we all together as a society made, and that without those public investments, they're not going to have the level of wealth that they had. And he would even point as an example to his own son and the wealth of Microsoft that was built on a platform of public investments and public knowledge. And, you know, he obviously added something to it, but he doesn't get to claim the whole, mountain, if you will. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think that was, you know, in that spirit, the Patriotic Millionaires Network that now has several hundred members. These are people who we could say are kind of the icons of success. They have a lot of wealth are founders of successful enterprises, but they will be the first person to tell you that they didn't do it alone, that they got help along the way, whether it was private institutions or mentors or librarians, but also public investments that made their own individual private wealth possible. And their view is a good society, if you achieve that level of wealth, then you pay back so that the next generation and who are not born wealthy can have the same opportunities. And I think that's, you know, it's a win-win. They see a virtuous circle in that idea that, you know, we don't just pull up the ladder after you've got your wealth and hide your money offshore. You pay your fair share of taxes, and it makes it possible for children who are not rich to get and apply their skills and talents to their own lives.
Absolutely. And you've been really in the forefront both on research and writing, kind of helping us all understand the levels of wealth inequality that are out there and what the damage it does to our country when we have that level of wealth inequality. And you've been in the forefront about bringing people together to do something about it. What do you see as some of the solutions? How do we deal with this? I mean, this is not just the natural order of things that the rich are going to get richer, but what do we do to kind of get things back in a more even keel?
Well, I think one thing, Eleanor, is to realize that we have done that before in the decades after World War II, 1947 to say the mid-70s, we had what I would call a shared prosperity economy. We taxed wealth at very high levels and invested in debt-free higher education, small business loans, low-interest loans to purchase homes, public infrastructure that lots and lots of businesses were built on. And so we really invested in building a middle class. Unfortunately, I would say primarily a white middle class. A lot of blacks and Latinos and Native Americans that were kind of left out of some of those wealth-building programs because of discrimination. Not entirely, but pretty systematically. But that was an example. We can reorient the rules of the economy. You know, the last 40 years, they've been focused on funneling wealth to the top, as you said. So we can say, look, what would it look like? We could tax very high incomes and inheritances at high levels. We could invest in things that enable people to get on the wealth building train. You know, I had an uncle from Ohio, one part of my family's a wealthy family, but he bought a farm for a 35-year 1% farmer's home mortgage in the early 50s. So that farm became the foundation. I think he paid $95 a month in his mortgage payment. We could do that again. We could, the home ownership rate is actually declining. What if we said, let's help first-time home buyers get access to low-interest loans to purchase homes, just like previous generations did, or low-cost college, like previous generations. So there, it's sort of a no-brainer. We can rewire the economy for growing together as opposed to pulling apart.
Right, that's beautifully said. And so right, and I don't think people are aware on some of these rules, like just looking at taxes, for example, that if you look since World War II, or around World War II, corporations and the very wealthy paid a lot more of the federal taxes. And over time, that tax burden has shifted over to the middle class. You know, in the 1950s, corporations paid a third of the federal budget. Now they're only paying 10%. And meanwhile, you've got these giant corporations like Amazon made $10 billion in profit last year but paid zero in federal taxes. I mean, that's just really not fair. It's not soaking the rich to say that if you've got a company that's making $10 billion in profit, you should be paying some into the federal budget so we can have quality education. I love your plan, having a lower cost for education, having low interest loans to buy a home. I think that's really great. So I think maybe where we need to start here is to shift the taxes back so that they're more progressive and corporations and the very wealthy pay more and the middle class pays less. Do you think that's the right way to go?
I do, and it's not just because we want to raise more money to invest in things. It's also, at this point, very important to protect our democracy from these concentrations of wealth and power. So I sometimes argue it would be good to have a plutocracy prevention program, a tax program, and what I would recommend is you increase the inheritance tax so that huge fortunes, when they transfer to the next generation, a fair amount of that gets taxed. You levy an annual wealth tax like the one Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposed. Senator Sanders has a proposal. You tax wealth above $50 million on an annual basis. And then you levy a surtax on incomes over $2.5 million, $3 million. So a 10% surtax on incomes above that level, whether the income comes from investments, capital gains, or from wages. If you do those three things, that really within 15, 20 years, within a generation, we will greatly reduce the concentrations of wealth at the top, and we'll also generate a lot of revenue for investments that help build a middle class and build social mobility and opportunity.
I like that program, and I think it was Bernie Sanders saying if you were to do one thing to try to level the playing field more for people regarding wealth, you would have that inherited wealth tax. And I don't think people are aware that 2017 tax bill that the Republicans passed was a dramatic cut in corporate taxes and more cuts to the top rate for the individuals, and now increasing the level of money you need to have before you trigger the inherited wealth tax. I think they moved it up for something like $5.5 million per person. They doubled it. It's $11 million a person, so it's $22 million for a couple. I mean, how many people is that affecting, really? So it's it's so ridiculously protective of people of an inherited wealth. So I love your program. Are you going to run for office so we can vote for you to enact it?
No, but I'm cheering on a lot of people who are running for office. And actually, one, I would say that people should run with this program because it's wildly popular. You know, a majority of Republican voters support a wealth tax on households over 50.
Is that true? A majority of Republicans?
Yes. It polls 75% of the public support it.
Wow.
They support the surtax idea. These are not marginal ideas. These are majority popular ideas. And if people run for office on them, in most places in this country, they'll win because, you know, we have this disconnect now. We have this great mass of people who really want to address these inequalities, whether it's low minimum wage or the dangerous concentration of wealth at the top. And the more people who run for office, the more people who will get elected on that program, and we'll actually see some shifts.
Wow, that's exciting. Well, we're seeing both Elizabeth Warren with her campaign, to the extent she was able to run, she just dropped out. But Bernie Sanders is making incredible headway. I think there's tremendous energy around wanting to change the structure of inequality that we've got. Just change the rules and make it more fair so it isn't so stacked against the working families. You mentioned here and in your powerful writing over time that you come from a family of wealth and you decided to give your wealth away. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you when, you know, everybody else seems to be scrambling trying to get more, even the very wealthy keep trying to amass more. What motivated you to give your wealth away, and what happened there in your mind and your being?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long time ago. I was in my early 20s. I'm 60 now. But it was a decision that really came out of seeing the inequalities in the society and also just recognizing, to be honest, that I have a lot of other advantages that are kind of wired into my life. And aside from inheriting money, you know, I'm white, I'm male, I grew up in a kind of a healthy, educated family with access to schools tutors and help along the way. So I feel like I got an enormous head start. The worst thing that was going to happen to me, I was going to be a white middle class male in the United States, which is, not a bad place to be from a global point of view. So I think I was tuned into that. I had worked for Catholic Relief Services in El Salvador. I had a sense of where we fit into the world and where I fit into the United States. And, I felt like I was fortunate and that the wealth I had, that I was going to be okay without the wealth I had, and it was time to pass the gift along. So it's not a decision I would, recommend or impose on anyone else. It was what I needed to do at that time in my life to move forward. It did give me an insight into how wealth inequality works, though, because I was both, from a family where wealth was multiplying at the top, but I was also working with, tenants in mobile home parks trying to buy their mobile home parks as cooperatives, and I got a real front row seat into how inequality was affecting people. So it very much has informed the choices I've made in my life.
That's amazing. And now looking back over it here at this stage in your life, are you glad that you did give your wealth away, or do you wish you would save more? What's your feeling about it now?
I have no regrets. I think I was in my 20s. I didn't have any responsibilities in terms of children. I do have children who have student debt, and I feel bad that they have student debt, and yet I have a stake in making sure that we all work together to build a society where young people don't graduate, not just my children, but no children graduate with extreme levels of debt. So I have a stake in making this a more fair economy, just like everybody else. And I'm not opting out personally, and I think that at some point in my 20s, I had an insight that was going to be important. So I have no regrets about that.
That's awesome. And as much as anybody I know, Chuck, you've really walked your talk, and I so admire your decision of your 20s and your whole living your life in a principled way and working to address this this very difficult, thorny issue about our wealth inequality. And I just think every day about the people, because they don't have wealth, they don't have the education they deserve, they don't have the ability to start a business they want to do, they have a yoke of the student debt around their neck. And I think of all the genius and creativity that we're losing because people are struggling financially. So I so appreciate everything you've done to help create a more fair economy. Can you tell our listeners who want to learn more about your work, like how can they be in touch with you? Tell them about your website.
Yeah, I would say the most important thing is to visit inequality.org, which is a website that I co-edit. And we even send out a newsletter every week that comes from me that's kind of a roundup of both what's going on, but also, what are the different ways in which people are trying to address inequality? What are sort of hopeful stories and inspiring stories of campaigns and efforts to reverse these inequalities? So I would encourage your listeners to check out inequality.org and learn more about what we're doing at the Institute for Policy Studies on these inequality issues.
Fantastic, and we'll have you back on the show when you come up with your next book about the wealth defense industry.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have. Chuck Collins, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your amazing work.
Thanks, Eleanor. Take care.